From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And this morning, we have a conversation with National Geographic explorer and internationally acclaimed wildlife expert James Curry. We'll talk about the arc of his career from a wildlife safari guide in Africa to his Discovery Channel show on birding. We're going to also discuss his efforts documenting elephants, specifically the big tuskers, and we'll dive into his work as a conservationist with Great Plains Conservation. That's all in the first part of the show.
Then author and animal and plant correspondent for the New York Times, Kara Jaimo, comes on the show to discuss her most recent book, Atlas Obscura, Wildlife, an Explorer's Guide to the World's Living Wonders.
This book takes readers around the globe from Antarctic deserts to lush jungles and into the deepest fathoms of the ocean. Wildlife reinvigorates our sense of wonder and amazement about the incredible creatures we share on our planet.
Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
So first, we will be speaking with James Curry. James, thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've done a lot in the world of wildlife. I want to begin, first of all, with your origins and your love for birding and wildlife conservation and how that all began. Can you share with us when and where that first started?
Sure. I grew up in one of the most beautiful cities in the world, Cape Town in South Africa. And as a young boy, I used to get sort of unprecedented access to Kirstenbosch National Botanical Gardens because my parents worked there and basically owned the restaurant in the garden. So I would get to go there, you know, 3 hours before the gates opened and the throngs of tourists arrived. This was my playground as a boy, and this was where my love for birding and for conservation took root.
You also penned a book, and in it you speak to that first moment when you saw both the beauty of nature and
the reality,
the realities of nature as well. Can you talk us through, as a boy, that moment you explain and this was what you thought you would do for the rest of your life?
Yeah, sure. You know, I remember that moment like it was just yesterday. In birding, we say that most birders who strike up a lifelong passion for birding have what's called a spark bird moment. And a spark bird moment is seeing that one bird that gets you hooked on birding for the rest of your life. And that happened to me at a very young age, fortunately. And it happened in Kirstenbosch National Botanical Gardens, in fact, on the mountain above. And I was watching a group of rock hyraxes sunning themselves in the early morning sun. And rock hyraxes, for those that don't know what they are, they're kind of like these rodent-like creatures. They're quite sort of chubby, about the size of a rabbit, but they're actually more closely related to elephants than to anything else. And I was watching this group of them sunning themselves, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw this shadow fly in, and it was a majestic and really beautiful black eagle. It's now called Vero's eagle in South Africa, and it's one of the largest eagles, and sadly, they don't exist on Table Mountain anymore. But as a boy, there were a couple of pairs that still existed there. And I watched as this black eagle swooped in and grabbed a rather portly rock hyrax that was trying to get away into one of the crevices and carried it off into the early morning light. And I still remember the you know, black eagles have this white patch on their back, which looks like a V for victory. And I saw it banking in the morning light with that V for victory. And this happened literally like 15, 20 feet in front of me. And I knew from that moment on that I wanted to chase this kind of experience for the rest of my life.
So you had this sense of place and this love of birds and this trajectory. Walk us through first, though, you started out as a guide and a ranger. And again, in your book, you share some experiences that were fascinating and both rewarding, but also you had your fair share of stories that came with some peril, I would say. Because in the part where you were a guide, you could get out of the vehicle and walk around. So that, I'm sure, came with perilous situations. Can you talk about some of those that you vividly recall in those days?
Yeah, I mean, you know, guiding's changed a lot since when I was a guide in the 1990s. We've had to become a lot more careful. Mm-hmm. There's had to be a lot more emphasis on not just the safety of the guests that we're guiding, but the guides themselves. But, you know, when I was a guide, there was a lot more latitude given to us in terms of being able to get out there and experience nature. And it does come certainly with its risks. And I know in the book, I talk about one particular experience where I was actually a birding guide at the time. And I was taking a client to look for wattled cranes, which are the tallest cranes in Africa, actually. And they're found in Botswana in fairly good numbers. And in other places as well, like northern Namibia in the Caprivi Strip. And I took a trip up with this guest one year, I think this was about the year 2000. And we were looking for wattled cranes in Mahango Game Reserve. And there are lions there, but they're not very, very common. And it is a park where you can walk on foot. So I went out to go look for these cranes. And I'm not going to go into the story in too much detail because we don't have a lot of time, but basically, I looked at all these cranes. I saw them on the floodplain, about 40 of them, and they took off right in front of me. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I'd left my guest in the car, and now I'm going to have to go back and break the news that, you know, we can't find these cranes. Mm. And then I looked back to where the cranes had been in the grass, and I thought maybe there's just one or two left. And I saw a big male lion coming towards me on the open floodplain. I'd walked down through some fairly thick bush. And basically, to cut a long story short, I got trapped between a male lion and his pride. And I got charged several times. And it was very nerve-wracking, but got back to the car and managed to survive by not running and standing my ground with these lions. But they charged me about six or seven times before I got back to the vehicle. And I got into the car, and I'll never forget my British guest in this very prim and proper and clipped British accent said to me, he turned and looked at me and his eyes were as big as saucers because he had just seen the last charge from these lions in full view of the vehicle. And he turned to me and he said, oh, James, the things we do for birds. Yes. I remember thinking, where's the we in this?
Exactly.
And yeah, you also allude to that in your book about how birds can take you into different places when you're following them, and they can be elusive. And Africa is home to, what, some odd, almost 2,500 species of birds? And about 1,400 are endemic.
So yeah,
you can get in some trouble there if you're following them around, yes?
Yeah, there are. There are about 2,500 species in Africa, and that's about 25% of the world's population or diversity of species. And that's exactly right. You know, there's a big difference between bird watching and birding. Bird watching is a passive pastime. It's, you know, putting out some bird feeders and watching birds come to your feeders at your house. That to me is bird watching. But birding is very different. It's an active pursuit. It takes you to the far corners of the earth, of the globe, looking for rare species to tick off on your list. And it puts you in some very interesting situations. And, you know, birding is always the avenue for great other adventures and travel experiences, like excellent food and culinary experiences and cultural experiences in these different parts of the world. So birding for me has always been the vehicle through which I experience travel.
Yeah, and at least for a while, you're a host of a birding show on the Discovery Channel. And watching a few of those episodes in preparation for this interview, I'm always amazed at how you know, the show's premise, today we're going to go out and look for a white-headed woodpecker. Is there, you know, very relatively rare, I would say. And then you end up seeing a white-headed woodpecker. How does that happen? Because every day I go out looking for a western tanager, I have no guarantee that I'll ever see a western tanager. How much patience and time is involved in capturing, you know, ultimately the birds you're looking, you know, the elegant trogon and et cetera?
Yeah, you know, it does take a lot of research. You know, our show, Nikon's Birding Adventures, which was on Destination America for a number of years, and also on NBC Sports, it was a very low-budget show. It was just me and a cameraman, and I did all the bird filming through my equipment. And then, you know, I had a cameraman to film some of the scenery and the interviews, etc. But we would film an entire show in 3 days. So to get our target species was often really tough. Yeah. And we relied predominantly on local guides. So local knowledge is key. You know, for me, living in Florida, to just go out to Oregon and go and find a white-headed woodpecker, for example, would be a challenge.
Yes.
You got to know where to go, what the habits of the birds are, you know, best time of the day to see them, lots of variables. So we would always rely on local guides. And I think in 120 episodes that we filmed around the world, I think there were maybe only a handful, maybe five, where we didn't find our golden bird or our target species. Mm. And then we'd always just have a backup and we'd have to kind of sort of fabricate the show to incorporate a different species as our target species. But yeah, it took a lot of planning, a lot of research, and a lot of use of local guides and local knowledge.
Well, another bird that was really interesting that you saw on that episode was the northern pygmy owl. And it's a very small, as by its name, it's very small and ferocious, I believe is the term you use. But it also has an amazing coloration in the sense that the back of its head actually has feathers or colors arranged to look like a face of an owl, the eyes set and maybe the nose. So that to a predator, it always looks like it's looking at them. That's an amazing type of camouflage or disguise that not just the owl, I'm sure many birds put on to help, you know, as a defense mechanism or so.
Yeah, you know, a lot of species use that, and it's not just birds, particularly owls. Even small owlets in Africa also have these what we call false eyes on the back of their heads. But, you know, butterflies, moths, there's quite a number of other species that also have this. And it's based on the premise that, you know, nobody likes to eat something that's looking back at them. So
I have to remember that.
Yeah, I mean, once a predator's lost the element of surprise, most predators will give up, actually, and not carry on a hunt or a stalk. And so having those false eyes on the back of the head just means that, you know, if a predator's coming in or in the area, it means that no matter which way the owl is looking, there's always something looking back at a predator.
And I believe you're still living down in Lake Worth, South Florida.
That's great. Yeah.
Because I have a friend of mine, good friend of mine, who is a very avid birder, travels about to find birds. And I believe he was just down in Gumbo Limbo Park, which I think is near Boca Raton, where he saw a banana quit. So an example of, you know, you travel about and how people really take this seriously, birding seriously, and will spend time and money and energy to go spot a bird to add to a life list. So it's an amazing activity and obsession with some, including you helping with the film called The Big Year, documenting just that.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's to a lot of people from the outside, it's bizarre.
Yes.
You know, because you've got people that will, I mean, I've heard crazy stories about rare birds that have been found in a particular area. And just to use your banana quit for an example, it's obviously a Caribbean species that very seldom is found in the United States or the continental United States. But as I always say, birds have wings and they can show up in the most unexpected places sometimes. But there are crazy stories about birders, you know, driving 1,000 miles to go and see a particular species of bird that showed up in a particular area, getting there only to find that the bird flies off right 5 minutes before they arrive.
Right.
And then staying overnight, going back home again, and then the bird shows up again. They fly down again the following day or drive down only to miss it again. So there's a lot of bird watchers and birders that will fly and go to extreme lengths and costs to add new species to their lists. But sometimes they're disappointed. I mean, birds have wings and they'll fly and they'll take off. And often it's just a matter of timing and luck.
Right.
We are speaking with National Geographic explorer and internationally acclaimed wildlife expert James Curry, and we're talking about the adventures of birding. And James, as you travel the world and you embark on these adventures, it brings to us the idea of preserving these habitats and these ecosystems that you're finding them in and the wild landscapes at large. And you have gotten into some areas of conservation, and specifically you look to a larger species, the elephants, and you documented the big tuskers that carry ivory tusks weighing upwards of 100 pounds. Can you tell us about this work as well and what populations are looking like today for these large animals?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a subject that's very close to my heart. In 2014, a friend showed me a photograph of an elephant in South Africa, northeastern South Africa, close to the border of Mozambique. And I looked at this photograph and I could not believe it, because this elephant looked like a mammoth. I mean, he was one of the largest elephants on the earth. He stood about 13 foot high at the shoulder and weighed about 7 tons in his prime. And his ivory was estimated to weigh about 160 pounds each side. So he was absolutely massive, probably at least 10 foot in length, each tusk, and right down to the ground. And I saw this elephant and I just couldn't believe it. And at the time I was doing a spec project for a major network called Last Chance to See. And it was all about seeing those things on Earth that you have to see now before you die. So, and before they go away, things like big tusker elephants, maybe the pyramids would be a good example in Egypt, etc. So we went out to go and film this elephant, and we were actually the last people on the planet to film him, because he died shortly after that and his tusks were never recovered.
Hmm.
And so it got me thinking, how many of these super tuskers are left? And doing my research and going around Africa trying to film the remaining super tuskers, when I started the film in 2014, there were only about 40 left in Africa. And that's an elephant that has at least one tusk weighing 100 pounds or more. And by the time we finished the film, there were estimated to only be about 22 left when we finished the film in 2018. So it's a massive problem, and it's something that I call human-induced evolution. Because basically, as we target elephants for their ivory, whether they be poachers or big game hunters, basically we are eradicating the genetic integrity of African elephants, their ability to hold large ivory, because we're killing the elephants, particularly the bulls, that have large ivory. And to this day, we still don't know whether the gene for large ivory is carried by the bull or by the cow or by both. And until we're able to figure that out, we are losing tusked elephants at an alarming rate. And it's not just large ivory. We look at populations of elephants, for example, Addo Elephant Park in South Africa, which came from a very small number of elephants that had very small ivory or no ivory. There's 90% tusklessness in that entire population. Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique is at about 60% tuskless, completely no tusks, those elephants. And then Queen Elizabeth Park in Uganda, I think, is at around 30% tusklessness. So what's happening is we as a species have handicapped elephants. because yes, they can survive, but the normal rate for tusklessness in a healthy elephant population is 3%. So to have 60% of the elephants or 30% or 90% running around without tusks means that we've got elephants that are essentially handicapped. It's like a bunch of humans running around with one arm. Yes, you can survive with help from your friends, but it makes life a lot more challenging. Elephants use their tusks to rescue their babies, defend themselves, pry bark off trees, dig for water. There's a lot of things they use their tusks for. So it's been alarming, not just that we've lost these super tusker elephants, which, you know, if you go back 100 years, there were thousands across Africa. But more alarming is that elephants are increasingly becoming tuskless completely. And I don't want my kids or my kids' kids to see African elephants that don't have ivory. I think that'll be a very sad day.
What is being done besides, you know, doing the best to protect them from poaching, et cetera?
So there are a number of organizations that are doing great work in this regard. There's a great organization in Kenya where the largest population of super tuskers exists called Tsavo Trust. They're doing excellent work monitoring and doing aerial surveys on the remaining big tuskers to ensure their protection. There's another organization called Big Life Foundation in Kenya that's also doing great work mitigating human-wildlife conflict, because that's also a major challenge to elephant populations. So there's a lot of good work being done, but I think the key thing that needs to be done with regard to preserving the remaining big tuskers is to get somebody to come out and do the research on the genetic research on the ivory, which is necessary. Then it would be very easy for us to target a young bull that has small ivory at this stage, because the ivory grows exponentially the older an elephant gets. So he might have small ivory at the age of 20, but if you could shoot a dropout dart, which hardly hurts an elephant, and get a sample and test it and find out that he has the gene for large ivory, you can then protect that young elephant. You can then relocate him to other populations which have a large propensity for tusklessness, and you can bring tusked elephants back into the elephant populations of Africa. And I think that's the most critical need right now that is not, that hasn't been done to this date. But there are currently a number of other good organizations that are doing work to protect the remaining ones. But I think it'll need a combination of both. We need to be able to isolate that gene, target those elephants, relocate them, and then do the protection which these great organizations are doing in places like Kenya.
Is poaching still the greatest threat to their population and survival, or is it other things like resource and habitat decline, et cetera?
Yeah, so it's unfortunately a potpourri of a number of issues. So, you know, that's the problem, is it's not any one thing. So poaching is definitely a big issue for the ivory trade, but so is trophy hunting, as I've just mentioned. There's still many African countries that allow hunting of large tusked elephants. And what you're doing there when you hunt a large tusked elephant is you're not just taking out a beautiful specimen that has incredible ivory, but you're ripping into the very fabric of elephant society, because the older you get and the bigger you are in elephant society, the more status you have. And a lot of research has been done on the role that old African bull elephants, especially super tuskers, play in the development of younger African bulls and making sure that they are productive members of elephant society. So it's very similar to humans in that way. So that's very destructive. But there are a number of other causes. Human-wildlife conflict or elephant-human conflict is a huge issue. You know, elephants go out of national parks to raid crops. They destroy the livelihoods of local communities. So we need to come up with ways that we can mitigate that. And there are a number of great initiatives that have had a lot of success with that. And then habitat destruction are also big issues. Droughts, climate change definitely affects elephant populations in a huge way as well. We've had a massive drought in southern Africa lately, and there have been elephants dying in huge numbers. So that's been a big issue as well. So it's really a whole sort of mix of issues that combine to create the demise of elephants. When I was born in 1972, there were probably 1.2 million African elephants on our planet. And today, there's probably no more than 400,000. So we've lost, you know, 66% of Africa's elephant population just in my lifetime alone.
And you also have some work that you do with Great Plains Conservation. Can you tell us about some of the work you're doing with them?
Sure. I'm the head of sales for the Americas for Great Plains. And basically my job is to get people, Americans in particular, and people that live in the Americas, Latin America and Canada, to travel to Africa and spend their well-earned dollars at our camps. We're essentially a not-for-profit company, although we are a for-profit company. Our shareholders don't take dividends. So all the profits that we make every year goes back into our foundation, which does incredible work with, you know, big cats. It does incredible work with communities, with elephants, with rhino relocations, with large rewilding of areas that have lost their wildlife. So we're doing really, really important work there with Africa's communities and with Africa's wildlife. And our goal as an income generating company is to expand the green frontiers of Africa so that we're putting large tracts of land under conservation or tourism versus more destructive practices like agriculture or hunting.
And in tourism, I was actually just there. I had the great pleasure of being at the Marototo camp, which is absolutely phenomenal. And it was a wonderful experience. And as you go out there on these drives, I know for me, I have a great reverence for it. And it is so spectacular to see these animals in their own environment. And it does lead you, I think, to hopefully care more and do more and want to preserve. What would you like for tourists to do, or what's the best way for a traveler to be in order to keep these wonderful landscapes and these animals alive and well?
I think first and foremost, the most important thing is to choose your operator and who you travel with and what lodges you go to very carefully. There are a lot of operators in Africa that do things amazingly, even our competitors that do incredible work with conservation and communities in Africa. But there's some that don't. And I think there's no harm in, before you're traveling to a destination like Africa, in asking the lodge or the operator or the travel agent that you book through, what are the sort of conservation ethics of the particular company that I'm traveling with, and making sure that there's things taken into account, like being plastic neutral or plastic negative in terms of plastics in camp. Things like solar power in camps is huge. Almost all our camps run off solar power. And so looking at that is really important, but then also looking at the work that they do with the profits that they generate. There's a big problem in Africa of something that we call economic leakage, where, you know, foreign companies or wealthy individuals will start a safari lodge in Africa, and then the money just flows out of that country and into that person's pocket. So the more that money stays in the country for the good causes of local people, local governments, and wildlife, the better. So choose your operator carefully. Vet them, make sure that they're doing good work before you travel. And I think that's the best way to make a lasting impact on Africa at a continental level.
Well, we could go on and talk to you all day about these topics and about conservation. We do need to wrap up. But James, if people wanted to learn more about your efforts or to learn more about Great Plains Conservation, where would they go?
Sure. My sort of TV work is on Instagram is A Wild Connection, and then on Facebook, the same, A Wild Connection. And with Great Plains, it's Great Plains Conservation. So we've got a number of excellent Instagram channels, Great Plains Conservation, Great Plains Foundation as well, if you want to learn about our conservation efforts.
And also the book, When Eagles Roar, I recommend it. It's a wonderful read. And thank you so much for being a part of this Green Earth. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having
Thanks,
me.
James.
It's been a pleasure.
And joining us as our next guest, Kara Jaumo. She is the author of the book Atlas Obscura, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Living Wonders. Kara, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with kind of the motivation behind this book. It's really fascinating to think, to look at all the different animals, insects, marine life, et cetera, birds.
Microbiomes. I mean, it's crazy.
Who develop kind of defense mechanisms or ways to adapt to certain difficult environments, et cetera. Where does this start? What was the motivation behind it? What was the, was there a single animal or insect that you saw that, that's like, you know what, that's unbelievable. There's got to be more of this out there.
Yeah. So this is the third book in the Atlas Obscura book series. And the first couple of books, the whole point of Atlas Obscura as a company and all of the books is to kind of like help people find wonder in the world, whether that's like in everyday life or by traveling and seeing something new. And so I'm a wildlife journalist. I write about interesting animals and plants. And like you said, like microbes and all these other amazing species that kind of live alongside us and have similar problems to us and similar goals, but have found really unique ways of addressing them. Mm. And so when they asked me to help out on this book, I was really excited because I'm really used to, you know, like writing about one species at a time, which is very cool and fun. But the idea of taking all these things that I knew about and finding new things and putting them together into a big book was really exciting because, like you said, there's just so much out there. And so the idea that we could try to collect even a small handful of these cool examples in one book was inspiring.
Yeah, and you got input from many different people. The research must have been pretty intense into deciding what you're going to place into the book. How far reaching did that research go?
Yeah, so it was definitely a very long and deep and intense process. I think I got a little bit obsessed with it, which in retrospect was good for the book, I think. Mm-hmm. But I can tell when I'm flipping through, I'm like, you know, this is the only thing I was thinking about for a few years. Mm. But I also had, a lot of help and collaboration. There are a lot of this book I wrote through talking to researchers and other people who have close relationships with some of these species. There are short interviews in the book that kind of detail those relationships and these different forms of expertise. So not just with scientists, but with people who have different kinds of relationships with the animals. And then I also collaborated with a number of writers from around the world who maybe also know these species really well because they live near them or they've studied them. And so we had writers from actually all seven continents file stories, which is cool. We had a story filed from Antarctica, which isn't something I expected to happen when we started this process, but which was very exciting to me. There's a short Antarctica section in the book in the deserts chapter, because Antarctica is actually the world's largest desert because it never rains there. So it was great. It was a real, like, it was a real collaborative effort, and then it was also a real obsessive effort by me.
Well, you move geographically from page to page, but the book does feel like you could flip it anywhere, and it's almost like a treasure hunt where you can find something interesting, and you don't necessarily have to read it end to end, but you can decide what adventure that you go on.
Yeah, that's a great comparison. I've heard it's been fun to sort of see how people react to the book and what they compare it to. I've also heard it compared to, like, a yearbook for the animal and plant kingdoms, which I thought was pretty funny. But yeah, it's organized by the chapters are each a different biome. So we have forests and rainforests, grasslands and tundras, deserts, mountains, oceans, cities and islands. And then within that, like you said, it's geographical. So you can get the feeling that you're traveling the whole world within a single chapter.
So what does it take for an animal or a species to qualify for the book? And let's say under mountains or so. What, give us an example of some species that the book highlights.
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it's something I thought about a lot because in a book like this, to get that treasure hunt feeling, you really want to, and to also sort of get across the amazing diversity and interestingness of the world, you don't want to have anything be too like samey. Like, for one thing, you don't want to include too many examples of one type of animal or plant, like mammals, or trees, at the expense of a different one. But then you also want to include things that are interesting for different reasons. So even within the mountains chapter, I guess one example of this is we have a section on snow leopards, which is an animal that I think people know about. But we tried to really dig deep and find some interesting facts about them that people might not know already. And we spoke to some experts. But then we also have a little section on the Andean cat, which was one of my favorite animals to learn about. It's another mountain cat, but it's so rare and hard to find that even people who research it for decades don't necessarily ever see it in person. A lot of the contact they have with this animal that they're experts in is through, scat or footprints or camera trap footage. So really trying to sort of run the gamut between, like, this is a well-studied and well-known animal, or this is one we barely get to encounter. So that's, one example of the spectrum.
It's really interesting you mentioned a snow leopard, because that's one of the books I read back when I was a teen or college or so, the Peter Matthiessen's amazing book. And that was one of the kind of the touchstones I used to pursue a career in the environmental field. So thank
Oh,
you for
cool.
mentioning the snow leopard, because it
Oh,
was
yeah.
quite endangered. But I believe there's been some preservation and conservation activities associated with them.
Yes, people are definitely trying to help them thrive. And yeah, that book I think was a touchstone for a lot of people. That's another reason that an animal can end up in the book, is because it's had an impact on human culture in maybe like an unusual or specific way.
Along with the fascinating creatures that you give accounts of, you also cover how humans impact wildlife.
Yeah, absolutely. So we had some kind of rules for the book. We didn't want to include domestic species because we had to limit ourselves somehow, right? But obviously, the natural world and the human world are not separate. I know that you guys talk about that every week. So we all interact and intersect, and I didn't want to leave that out of the book. So that's a big part of it.
And we had last week even a quite a robust conversation about zebra mussels and how they wreak havoc on some water bodies because of the way that they will filter. And you,
Invasive
they're
species.
invasive species, but you have talked about mussels in a way that they're being utilized to study contaminants, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah, so the cities chapter, which is where those mussels appear, was one of the most interesting chapters for me to write because it illustrates what you just said, how humans and other species actually interact all the time in all kinds of different ways. So these mussels that you're mentioning now, are mostly swan mussels, but other freshwater mussels as well. And in Poland, basically the people who run the water supply and make sure that clean water is getting to people, in the cities of Warsaw and Poznan and other large cities in Poland, they use these mussels as part of their sort of contamination alert system. So if you want to test water for contaminants, you kind of have two choices. One is that you can be super specific and do chemical tests, but then you can only really test for one thing at a time. Or you can try to cast a wider net. And the way that they've decided there to cast the wider net is to use these freshwater mussels who are very sensitive. When the water is clean, the mussels open up and they let the water go through them. And if there's something really bad in the water, the mussels literally clam up, they close their shells. And so within these water filtration plants, they have teams of mussels, I think maybe eight at a time. And if enough of them close very tightly at the same time, a sensor triggers and they shut off the water and they try to figure out what's wrong using some of these more specific tests. But if the mussels are open and just living their lives, then they know that the water is safe for mussels and humans. And my favorite part about that story was that each mussel works for 3 months. And then after that, they get to retire. So they just put them back in the river. But it's a cool example of using the talents of these different species to help us, especially without harming the creatures, which I think is a really, really cool way of collaborating.
Well, along the lines and staying over there in far Eastern Europe, you actually have a section on Chernobyl called the Chernobyl Exclusion Zone, an entire ecosystem that, of course, humans fouled, let's say, but now nature has taken over. Talk a little bit about what's going on there.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Obviously, the Chernobyl explosion was a huge tragedy. And then since then, the place where it happens has become very interesting for a number of reasons. But I think for people who study wildlife, it's particularly interesting for two reasons. One is that you can study the impact that radiation has on the creatures who live around there. But then the other is you can study the sort of counterbalancing impact that not having people around has on a place where people used to be. And there are rewilding movements all over the world to kind of take land that's been used by humans and quote unquote, give it back to nature, stop, you know, building on it or cutting down trees or whatever you might otherwise do. This is sort of a natural instance, not natural. This is a like an automatic or necessity-based instance of this because people can't be in this irradiated zone. And so it's an opportunity to study both of those things. And people have found some really interesting stuff there. Definitely, there's evidence that some of these creatures are doing badly, especially right after the radiation impact. But even, you know, years later, there are impacts from that. But not having human pressure is actually helping a number of species and making it a very biodiverse place. So, yeah, I mean, out of this tragedy comes at least a place where we can get some interesting information.
Yeah, it is. It's a strange example of how, like you say, a tragedy, human caused, you know, radiation, radiating the environment, and then just leaving it alone and seeing how wild. Kind of like what happened during COVID and the pandemic. You know, we stayed inside and we let wildlife return to areas that, or come back and explore areas that we had taken from them. So. An interesting example there. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Kara Jaimo. She's the author of the book Atlas Obscura, Wildlife, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Living Wonders. Let's go down into one of my favorite places, the deep sea, because there's so much yet to be found down there. Give us some examples of creatures that populate the deep seas that are in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my favorite spreads to work on with a freelance contributor for this book was we have a spread called A Deep Dive on Deep Dives. In addition to these like small profiles of species that are throughout the book, we tried to sometimes bring information together in a new way. We made a bar chart of like the deepest diving animals in the ocean, not just in terms of like, okay, they're going from the surface to a certain amount down, but like just in terms of the absolute value of the distance they travel. And I learned a lot from this. One of the funniest things in it is the southern elephant seal can dive 7,835 feet, which is the deepest diving non-whale mammal. But then because of that, the southern elephant seal louse, which is a little louse that lives on the elephant seal, can dive that far too because it's attached to the flippers of the seal. So I thought that was kind of fun to learn about. There's also, you know, all these really incredible creatures that we only really get to see at their worst, because by the time they get to the surface, they don't look like they're supposed to, and they're not feeling very well. But looking at them in their natural habitat, they're glorious. So like the Pacific football fish, when people find them occasionally on the beach, they look sort of like blobby and strange, but down in their habitat, which is down to 3,000 feet sometimes. They're just like these monstrous, impressive predators that have this cool little dangly lure, and they're incredibly good hunters. They have these spiky teeth. It really is a whole other world down there that we're just beginning to understand.
And I particularly looked at that fish, and to give you an example, the listeners out there, of what it looks like, it's like the luring fish in Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You can get that visual there, except for I think they made it look a little bit more enticing in Finding Nemo, because that fish is, I don't know if it got like really drew the look straw. It does. It's a very interesting looking animal, but that leads me to a lot of the times people tend to care about or lean into the creatures and the animals that are cuddly and furry and cute, but we don't often pay attention to the ones that aren't so cuddly and cute, and how much the role that they also play in ecosystems and keeping our landscapes alive and well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I said before that I tried hard to balance different types of species in the book, but I think I do have a real soft spot for insects in particular. So I think there are a lot of bugs in the book. And that was my way of maybe trying to address that, because like you said, there are so many amazing species that are not necessarily as visually appealing as others. Although, you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder. I think bugs are often quite beautiful and cute, but I understand that other people don't. So you'll definitely find a lot of creepy crawlies in this book, bats, bugs, strange looking fish, but hopefully readers will come away with a new appreciation for them. And like you said, all the things that they do.
How has a warming planet, warming oceans, et cetera, impacted some of these species? What changes can we, or are we seeing with respect to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was kind of, you know, it ended up being a theme throughout the book because you can't ignore it. Climate change is happening everywhere. It's happening to everyone. And it's happening so quickly that even these species that are so adaptable, so great at over evolutionary time, you know, solving these problems, meeting their goals, it's happening too fast for many of them to keep up. I found this was especially apparent in the mountains chapter, at least the way it turned out. Almost every entry in that chapter was like heavily inflected by climate change. So for example, and to give a bug example, we have a section on glacier stoneflies, which live beneath glaciers in Glacier National Park. So, you know, often in mountainous areas, and they live under glaciers, so they need glaciers to survive, to like go through their life cycle. And because of this, they are some of the species who are most clearly impacted by climate change, because climate change is melting the glaciers. And so there's not a lot of hope for them in terms of survival. And they are just these like very sort of standard looking buggy bugs. But I wanted to make sure that we included them because they are on the vanguard of, you know, this big sweeping problem that is affecting everyone. On the flip side of that, a couple pages later, we have a story about American pikas or pikas. Yeah. I actually still don't know how to pronounce them. Sorry. Yeah. Is it pikas or pikas?
I don't know. That makes two of us.
But pikas, you know, they're so cute and furry. And like you said, they're very charismatic. Right. People love them and they have this adorable habit of sort of like harvesting flowers and plants. And there are all these cute pictures of them with little bouquets in their mouths because they're going to store them away for winter.
Right.
They also are affected by climate change because they are like big and fuzzy and they don't want it to be super warm. It's not good for them physiologically. But researchers who observe them have shown that they, even as the temperatures get hotter in the mountains where they live, they just change their behavior. So they come out at different times of day. They stay in their caves when it gets too hot. So they are adapting, at least for now, behaviorally. But these are, you know, two different stories happening in the American mountains because of climate change that may end very differently. And again, it's just interesting to see how it's all playing out.
Well, again, the name of the book is Atlas Obscura Wildlife, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Living Wonders. Kara, the book is out and available now. Is there a website associated with it too?
Yeah, so this is an Atlas Obscura book. It was produced, by the Atlas Obscura company. I used to work as a staff writer there. You can find more information on the book and the sort of Atlas Obscura view of the world on atlasobscura.com, but you can find the book in bookstores and online bookstores and pretty much everywhere.
Well, it's a beautiful book and it is chock full of incredible information. Kara, thanks so much for joining us here on This Green Earth.
Yeah, thank you guys so much.